Welcome to Abide in Liberty, a podcast empowering patriots everywhere to re-enthrone faith, family, and freedom as the bedrock pillars of liberty in education, our communities, and our nation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back for another episode of Abide in Liberty. Today, before jumping into the main topic that I'm going to cover for this week, as well as possibly for the next couple weeks here, I want to just address something that I came across in the news today. And I don't have the details exactly, but the idea and the perspective that was shared is kind of what I want to focus on. Apparently, somewhere in the Midwest, one of the states out there, there was a law that was trying to be passed to further restrict the availability of abortion on demand in one of these states. And this was a state that you would think that there would be enough Republican support in order to pass, and it got shut down. And so what's been going around, or at least what is reportedly going around, is the notion that kind of first showed its head during the 2022 election. And that notion is that the issue of abortion and of a pro-life position is an unpopular and an untenable position for Republicans to take in the upcoming election, that if you touch abortion, it's going to go badly. And the idea there, what spawned that idea, is Roe versus Wade was overturned, and shortly thereafter, the Republicans got demolished in what everyone thought was going to be a landslide victory. And so the conclusion that was drawn from that is that somehow talking about being against killing babies in order to escape personal accountability is unpopular, and maybe the Republicans should just stay away from that. Now, first of all, I don't accept that that is the issue that caused the election to go in a way different from what many people thought. I know personally, when I in Arizona was watching the Senate race and the debates between the incumbent Mark Kelly and the guy who was running against him, Blake Masters. Mark Kelly was the Democrat, Blake Masters was the Republican. I was listening to both of them, trying to see which of them would talk about the things that were of greatest importance. And when the issue of abortion came up, Mark Kelly kind of gave the default Democrat position, which is a pro-choice, my body, my choice. It's not our business to get involved with whether you kill your baby or not. And Blake Masters, the guy who was moderating the debate, asked Blake Masters about pro-life comments that he had made in the past, that abortion should be restricted and should only be in very rare instances. And as I was listening to that, my ears perked up and I was like, maybe here's a guy that is going to be willing to take a stand, to say what he actually believes, to take a position that killing babies, just because I want to be able to do what I want to do and not have to face the consequences of kind of what the whole procreative act is for in the first place, and that's creating life. But no, he was super wishy-washy on his answer and said, well, you know, I may have personal beliefs, but I believe that the law should be what the people say the law should be. So in other words, he didn't have an opinion, didn't state one. And for me, after listening to both of those candidates and both of them being not willing to stand up for what's right and true, either of them, I lost all motivation and all respect for either candidate of either party, and was not really all that excited about casting my vote that election. And I don't think I'm the only one that felt that way. There were a lot of wishy-washy candidates on both sides of the aisle, on the Republican as well as on the Democrat, that just kind of kept saying the same old lines and rehearsing the same old pithy sayings that have been going around in elections since the dawn of time, rather than addressing the real issues, you know. Anyways, so I guess enough said on that. But first of all, I don't just accept that the election went the way that it did, because speaking truth and standing up for life is the untouchable and something that you should stay away from. If anything, I think that election shows that the American people are hungry for candidates who are going to stand for something, who are going to stand for what's right, what's true, what's real. And the lack of that does not get us very excited to participate. Now, on the flip side, when you take a look at a place like Florida, that's typically a very purple state, divided right down the line between Republicans and Democrats, they're taking stands against what is wrong. They're taking stands against the notion that boys can become girls and girls can become boys, and that you should, you know, allow those types of transitions to happen in minors. And they're standing against a lot of the poison in the culture that is causing all the problems that we see. They're saying the hard things, and the people are rallying to that. And yes, that does tend to result, and that resulted in a Republican tidal wave, but I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that it's a Republican thing. I think the candidates that were running for those positions of sanity and reality and truth and God, just so happened to be Republicans. But what got people excited was the fact that we had politicians who were standing up for truth, for righteousness, for sanity. And if there had been candidates on the blue side of the aisle, on the Democrat side of the aisle, that were saying those same things, I think there would have been just as much excitement. I don't think the party is really important at all. It's the truth. It's the truth. And if you so happen to be a Republican and you're speaking truth and standing for that, and if you so happen to be a Democrat and you're speaking for truth and you're standing for that, I think you're going to have a whole lot of people who come behind you. If your message is not pro-Republican, or it's not the Democrat message, but it's a pro-American message, it's a pro-family message, it's a pro-faith message, it's a pro-right message, then you're going to have a lot of people that are just hungry for that breath of fresh air. So this just goes back to the point that, you know, so the idea that people are gathering from this is maybe if we need to, you know, the Republicans think that their political party is what's going to save the country. And we've talked about this, you know, my opinion, it's not a political party. The Republicans nor the Democrats are God. We need to be on team God, and that's what's going to save the country. But there's this idea that Republicans are the only ones that can win it. They can save the country, even though they haven't proven they can do that in the past. And so we need to stay away from the sticky topics like abortion in order to win. I think that's the exact wrong answer. That's the exact wrong way to go. We need to take a stand, whoever the candidate is, for team God and for team right and for team truth and for team reality. And we need to fight evil. Forget your political label. And if that means you lose, then so be it. It's far better to speak truth and not get elected than to lie through your teeth, to deny reality and arrive in Washington, but having left your soul behind. So if you're going to lose because you're willing to stand up and protect the unborn, then so be it. It's time for people to grow a backbone and care more about what's right than caring about winning. Because at the end of the day, I hate to tell you, the winning team is the team of right. It's not the team of wrong. It's the team of truth. It's not the team of evil. And if you sacrifice your soul, your values, your character, your virtue, and everything in order to get a short-term win for a political office, then you are on the wrong team. All right. So let's get into what I really want to talk about now that I've spent 10 minutes on that. This is going to be a multi-part series. I don't know exactly how many parts it's going to be. It depends on just how how long I end up talking and rambling here. Going back to the 2016 presidential campaign, when Trump started talking about we need more stuff being made in America, I completely disagreed because I had been taught differently in my Econ 101 class in college. I had learned that specialization was a good thing, that different countries, different states specializing in certain things meant that there was more prosperity. There was more, you know, if we have more of our clothing being made in China, for example, and at lower cost, we get lower cost clothing, and that frees up our labor force to focus on things like inventing iPhones and being doctors and making medical and technological advancements that then spread throughout the world and raise everybody in the world. And we've seen that that's been true as we've been allowed to focus on those innovations that has trickled down and blessed the entire globe. But this also ignored, because we've had this kind of short period of relative of really pretty incredible prosperity, we've kind of forgotten that sometimes things don't always work out perfectly. The bad things can happen to gum up the system. And so we've kind of been so focused on this globalization and specialization, and that it's always going to be good, that we neglected to prepare or to think about, seriously anyways, what would happen if something gummed up the works, like COVID, for example. So I want to talk about and explain first those economic principles that I learned about, which are true principles, by the way. But then I also want to share what recent experience teaches us about the reality of the world that we live in and how we need to be a little more selective about the things we choose to outsource individually in our families and as a nation. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. These economic principles that I learned about were good, but there's another principle of moderation that we had forgotten about, but were reminded of during COVID, and that we need to be very careful to not forget about so quickly. So let's talk about how decision-making and specialization work in a free market. So in a free market, each person decides what he or she is going to do with the resources that they have. And resources can be things like land, it can be money, it can be time. Time is a valuable resource and does impact the way that people decide what to produce and how to produce. Now, to really talk about this, though, and to make sense of all this, we have to understand the idea of opportunity cost. So the opportunity cost of making a decision is the value of what you give up when you make that decision. You can't do everything. So when you say yes to something, you have to say no to something else. So the cost of saying yes to option A is what you're giving up by saying no to option B. So a very simple example of this would be you're applying for a bunch of different jobs and you get two job offers. And let's say they're practically identical in every way. Job one is offering you $40,000 a year. And job two is offering you $100,000 per year. So the opportunity cost of accepting job two that's offering $100,000, what you're giving up by saying yes to that $100,000 job is the $40,000 you could get in job one. So the opportunity cost of accepting job two is $40,000. On the flip side, the opportunity cost of accepting job one, so the opportunity cost, what you give up by saying yes to the $40,000 a year job, you're giving up $100,000. So where is your opportunity cost lowest? It's in job two. So you're going to accept the job that offers $100,000. Now that seems very obvious. That's very basic. And you don't have to use all that fancy lingo to know that, well, I'm going to accept $100,000. But this concept of opportunity cost is important in understanding the basics of economics and how people make decisions. Now, in any job decision, as anyone who's done this and has been through this knows, the costs that are at play when you're making a decision like this are not just monetary costs. So let's say instead, this $40,000 job, job one, is you get to teach children. It's something you've loved doing. That's something I love doing. So that's kind of, this is your dream job, right? But job number two, you kind of have to sacrifice your soul, because to get that job, you're a crack dealer, right? So not only are you in a job where you're destroying other people's lives, your life could be destroyed. You could end up in prison or hurt, or something goes wrong when you tick off the wrong person. And not to mention the fact that you lose your soul and possibly eternal salvation. So that's kind of, there's a lot of other costs then that come into play. So what are the opportunity costs of accepting job number two? What are you giving up by saying yes to the crack dealing job that earns you $100,000 a year? Well, you're giving up a $40,000 stable job. You're possibly also giving up your freedom if you're caught. And there's an emotional, spiritual component and cost here that's really hard to measure. If you're a person of faith, you might see this as, well, I'm giving up the possibility of eternal bliss and happiness and worlds without end. That's too high of a cost. Which is why it's no surprise that folks who don't have that kind of moral guidance and background are the ones you typically find doing those kinds of jobs, because the opportunity cost is not nearly so high. So anyways, there's a lot of decisions that go into this. And this idea of opportunity cost is a way that economists use to explain people's behavior. You and I don't sit down and think in terms of opportunity cost, but we weigh the pros and cons and we pick the one that gives us the most benefit for the least cost and the least sacrifice. And that's kind of the idea of opportunity cost. Another example of opportunity cost is, if I decide to plant a garden, what am I giving up in time, for example, and what could I do with that time instead? If I'm going to spend an hour a week or an hour a day tending this garden, I'm giving up time that I could spend earning money at my job, if that's an option to me, or on a side gig. I'm giving up possibly time with my family, unless I can coax them out to weeds with me. There are still things I'm giving up. What is the value of that thing that I'm giving up in order to plant and maintain that garden? Another example is spending time on video games. What is the opportunity cost of an hour spent on video games, or even hours spent on video games? You know, if we were truly measuring the opportunity cost of that leisure time, we would probably realize it's quite high. Same thing with what's the opportunity cost of saying yes to an addictive substance or to pornography? You know, the developers of these addictive substances, and video games do qualify under that category, they're trying to create these dopamine hits that suppress your desire and your ability to think through the consequences of your actions clearly. I had this experience recently. We, got the kids a Nintendo Switch at the beginning of the summer, and we had very strict guidelines around how much, and I allowed myself to play this Zelda game a little bit. And there were a couple nights where, you know, I'm just going to sit down and play. But before doing that, I didn't really sit down and count the costs and think about what I had to do the next morning. So I stayed up later than I should have and ended up regretting it when I had to pay the opportunity cost of that decision, these costs that I didn't think about ahead of time, because I'd kind of gotten sucked into it. All right, so that's opportunity cost. Hopefully that makes sense. Now, the last thing that we need to talk about in order to really kind of understand what's going on is the idea of comparative advantage. So we're going to look at an example. I had to go back and dust off one of my intro to economics textbook from college to kind of come up with this in a way that will hopefully make sense. You have a farmer who produces two different things. He produces meat and potatoes. Now the farmer, it takes him about 60 minutes to produce 1 ounce of meat. On the other hand, it takes him about 15 minutes to produce an ounce of potatoes. So 60 minutes for an ounce of meat, 15 minutes for an ounce of potatoes. His neighbor, the rancher, though, can produce an ounce of meat in 20 minutes. So about a third of the time that it takes the farmer to produce meat. But he's also really good, or at least better at planting potatoes and growing potatoes than the farmer is. So it takes the farmer about 15 minutes to produce an ounce of potatoes, but the rancher can produce an ounce of potatoes in just 10 minutes. So 2/3 the time that the farmer does. Now the rancher in this case has an absolute advantage over the farmer. He is just simply better and faster at producing both of these things. But in a world where time is limited and where the rancher just cannot produce an infinite amount of meat and potatoes all by himself, he has to prioritize and decide. And if we're looking at this simple economy and we want to maximize how much stuff we produce, it doesn't make sense to just have the farmer sit at home all day and do nothing while the rancher works his tail off because he's the fastest at both of these tasks. One of them should focus on one and the other should focus on the other. So how do we determine who should do which? Well, so we have to look at the opportunity cost for each of them. So let's look at the opportunity cost to the farmer and to the rancher of producing 1 ounce of potatoes. So go with me on this. If you need to rewind and listen to this again, I'm going to try and explain this so we don't get too lost in the numbers. But the opportunity cost of the farmer for producing 1 ounce of potatoes. Remember, it takes him 50 minutes to produce an ounce of potatoes. and it takes him 60 minutes to produce an ounce of meat. So when he produces an ounce of potatoes, he's giving up the opportunity to produce meat. And in that 15-minute window, he could produce a quarter ounce of meat because it takes him 60 minutes to produce an entire ounce. So the opportunity cost for him to produce 1 ounce of potatoes is 1/4 ounce of meat. Now let's look at the rancher. The rancher can produce an ounce of meat for 20 minutes that he spends working and an ounce of potatoes in 10 minutes that he spends on potatoes. So in 10 minutes, if he goes and spends that time on potatoes, in that amount of time, he could have created or raised or produced a 1/2 ounce of meat because he can produce an ounce of meat every 20 minutes. So his opportunity cost, the opportunity cost of the rancher to produce 1 ounce of potatoes is 1/2 ounce of meat as opposed to the 1/4 ounce opportunity cost for the farmer. So what that means is the person who has the lowest opportunity cost, the one who is sacrificing the least in order to create that ounce of potatoes is the one who should be focused on potatoes. So the farmer, no surprise, you probably could have guessed where this was going, is going to focus, he's going to be dedicated to producing potatoes because his opportunity cost is the lowest. Now let's flip it around and look at what is the opportunity cost of the farmer and the rancher to produce an ounce of meat. So the farmer takes 60 minutes to produce an ounce of meat, 15 minutes to produce an ounce of potatoes. So in the 60 minutes that he takes to produce an ounce of meat, he could have produced 4 potatoes. The rancher, on the other hand, in the 20 minutes that he spends producing an ounce of meat, he could have produced 2 potatoes because it takes him 10 minutes to produce an ounce of potatoes. So the rancher's opportunity cost is 2 potatoes. The farmer's opportunity cost is 4. The one who has the lowest opportunity cost should be producing the meat, and that's the rancher. So if the farmer produces on the produces potatoes and spends 8 hours a day on that, the rancher produces meat and spends 8 hours a day on that, overall, they will have more potatoes and more meat than if they each were to focus and produce their own meat and potatoes, if they don't specialize. Hopefully all that makes sense. So although the ranch has an absolute advantage in producing both of these commodities in meat and potatoes, the farmer has a comparative advantage in producing potatoes because his opportunity cost to do so is lower than the rancher's opportunity cost. So this idea of comparative advantage, this is the whole idea behind specialization. So let's kind of play out actually real quick before we go on to the next part, how this would look. So the farmer doesn't know what the rancher's opportunity cost is, and the rancher doesn't know what the farmer's opportunity cost is. So the rancher might approach the farmer and say, "Hey, I'm really good at producing meat. I see you're pretty good at producing potatoes. How about you produce this much of potatoes? I'll produce this much of meat and we'll swap at this price, or we'll swap at this meat to potatoes exchange rate." And if that doesn't make sense, if that's not worth it to the farmer, they'll come back and they'll kind of propose a counteroffer and they'll kind of go back and forth until they settle on something that is beneficial to both of them. And this happening over and over again, million times a day, by individual people, by millions of individual people in this country, all works together to set prices and manage how much of the different goods that we need to produce without the government being there deciding, "Rancher, you're going to produce this much meat. Farmer, you're going to produce this many potatoes." The individual collective decisions of millions of people every single day working in their best interest to try and make the best life for them and their families results in this kind of perfect allocation of resources and time, or near perfect allocation of resources and time, without any central authority and command. And when we start to see imbalances like gasoline lines, like back in the 70s, that happens when government steps in and fixes prices and tries to regulate these things from a top-down way. And it just doesn't work. The free market's freakishly awesome. And every time we mess with it, we cause problems. And I should point out, you know, I talked about the farmer and the rancher. It's in their self-interest to work together in this way because they both end up with more meat and potatoes. Now, self-interest is not selfishness. it's not selfish for the rancher and the farmer to come together and work a deal that benefits both of their families. Each person acting in their self-interest results in a better world and more production for everybody. So just be careful. A lot of times people will talk about, oh, that evil free market system is all about self-interest. And yeah, it is. Me trying to do the best by my family is not evil. It's good. That's what I should be doing as a father and as a husband. That's what my wife and I should be working together to do. So anyways, enough on that. All right. We're out of time. That kind of is going to wrap up our introduction of the concepts that we need to really now dive in and talk and look at the issue of specialization. So make sure and come back next week and we'll start tackling some of the problems that come about when we over-specialize globally and internationally. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Abide in Liberty. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and share this with friends and family. In the meantime, keep up with the show online at abideinliberty.com. Also, if you'd like to help our K-12 bless and educate more families, contact us by visiting libertyyouthacademy.org. Until next time, be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, and be strong.